Chapter 25. It's Monday morning, 8:58 a.m., Aldridge's office. I'm sitting in a chair waiting for him to return from a partner meeting. I'm wearing a new theory suit with a silk high-necked camisole underneath. Nothing frivolous, all severity. I'm tapping my pen to the corner of my folder. I've brought all our recent deals, the success I've helped and, in some cases, overseen.
Ms. Cohan, Aldridge says, thank you for meeting me.
I stand and shake his hand. He has on a custom Armani three-piece suit with a pink and blue shirt and matching pink trim detail. Aldridge loves fashion. I should have remembered that.
How are you? He asks me.
Good, I say, measured. Fine. He nods.
Lately I've been noting your work, and I must say,
I can't bear it. I leap in. I'm sorry, I say. I've been distracted. My best friend has been very sick, but I've brought all my casework to the hospital and we're still on schedule with the Carbinger merger. Nothing has changed. This job is my life and I'll do whatever I can to prove that to you.
Aldridge looks puzzled. Your friend is sick? What's wrong?
She has ovarian cancer, I say. No sooner are the words out than I see them sitting on the table between us. They are bulking, unruly, bleeding. They ooze all over everything. The documents on Aldridge's desk. His gorgeous Armani suit.
I'm very sorry to hear that, he says. It sounds serious.
Yes.
He shakes his head. You've gotten her the best doctors?
I nod.
Good, he says. That's good.
His eyebrows scrunch and then his face descends into surprise.
I didn't call you here to reprimand your work, he says. I've been impressed with your initiative lately.
I'm confused.
I'll bet, Aldridge says. At this, he chuckles. You know QT?
Of course. QT is one of our tech companies. They're primarily known as being a search function, like Google, but they're relatively new and building in interesting and creative ways.
They are ready to go public.
My eyes go wide. I thought that was never going to happen. QT was created by two women, Jordy Hills and Anya Cho, from their college dorm room at Syracuse. The search function is outfitted with more youthful terminology and results. For instance, a search for Audrey Hepburn might lead you first to the Netflix documentary on her, second to E! True Hollywood Story, third to her presence in modern CW shows, and the ways to dress like her. Down the list, biographies, her actual movies. It's brilliant. A veritable pop culture reservoir. And from what I understood, Jordy and Anya had no intention of ever selling.
They changed their minds, and we need someone to oversee the deal.
At this, my heart starts racing. I can feel the pulse in my veins, the adrenaline kicking, revving, taking off.
Okay. I'm offering you to be the key associate on this case.
Yes, I say. I practically scream, unequivocally, yes.
Hang on, Aldridge says.
The job would be in California, half in Silicon Valley, half in Los Angeles, where Jordy and Anya reside. They want to do as much work as they can out of their LA offices, and it would be quick. We'd probably begin next month. Who is the partner, I ask?
Me, he says.
He smiles. His teeth are impossibly white.
You know, Danny, I've always seen a lot of myself in you. You're hard on yourself.
I was too. I love this job, I say.
I know you do, he tells me. But it's important to make sure the job is not unkind to you.
That's impossible. We're corporate lawyers. The job is inherently unkind.
Aldridge laughs. Maybe, he says. But I don't think I'd have lasted this long if I thought we hadn't struck some kind of deal.
You and the job. Aldridge takes off his glasses. He looks me square in the eye when he says, me and my ambition.
Far be it from me to tell you what your own deal should be. I still work 80-hour weeks. My husband, God bless him, wants to kill me, but
you know the terms.
He smiles, puts his glasses back on. I know the terms.
The IPO evaluation begins in mid-November. We're already creeping further into October. I call Bella at lunch while bent over a signature sweet green salad, and she sounds rested and comfortable. The girls from the gallery are there, and she's going over a new show.
She can't talk. Good. I leave work early, intent on picking up one of David's favorite meals, the teriyaki at Haru, and surprising him at home. We've been strangers passing in the night. I think the last time I had a full conversation with him was at the hospital, and we've barely touched our wedding plans. I turn onto Fifth Avenue and decide to walk. It's barely 6 p.m. David won't be home for another 2 hours at least, and the weather is perfect. One of those first truly crisp fall days where you could conceivably wear a sweater, but because the sun is out and still strong overhead, a t-shirt will do. The wind is low and languid, and the city is buzzy with the happy, contented quality of routine. I'm feeling so festive, in fact, that when I pass Intimissimi, a popular lingerie company, I decide to stop inside. I think about sex, about David, about how it's good, solid, satisfying, and how I've never been someone who wants her hair pulled or to be spanked. Who doesn't even really like to be on top? Is that a problem? Maybe I'm not in touch with my sexuality, which Bella casually, too casually, has accused me of on more than one occasion. The shop is filled with pretty lacy things. Tiny bras with bows and matching underwear. Frilly negligees with rosettes on the hems. Silk robes. I choose a black lace camisole and boy shorts, decidedly different from anything I own, but still me. I pay without trying them on, and then make my way over to Haru. I call in our order on the way, no sense in waiting. I can't believe I'm doing this. I hear David's key latch in the door, and I'm tempted to run back into the bedroom and hide, but it's too late now. The apartment is littered with candles and the low stylings of Barry Manilow. It's like a cliche sex comedy from the 90s. David walks in and drops his keys on the table, sets his bag down on the counter. It's not until he reaches to take off his shoes that he notices his surroundings. And then me. Whoa. Welcome home, I say. I'm wearing the black lingerie with a black silk robe, something I got as a gift on a bachelorette weekend eons ago. I go to David. I hand him one end of the belt. Pull, I say, like I'm someone else. He does, and the thing comes apart, falling to the floor in a puddle. This is for me? He asks, his index finger stretched out to touch the strap of my camisole top. It would be weird if it weren't, I say. Right, he says low. Yeah. He fingers the strap, edging it down over my shoulder. From an open window, a breeze saunters in, dancing the candles. I like this, he says. I'm glad, I say. I take his glasses off. I set them down on the couch, and then I start to unbutton his shirt. It's white. Hugo Boss. I bought it for him for Hanukkah 2 years ago, along with a pink one and a blue striped one. He never wears the blue one. It was my favorite. You look really sexy, he says. You never dress like this. They don't allow this in the office, even on Friday, I tell him. You know what I mean. I get the last button undone and I shake the shirt off him, one arm, then the other. David is always warm, always. And I feel the prickle of his chest hair against my skin, the soft folding my body does to his. Bedroom? He asks me. I nod. He kisses me then, hard and fast, right by the couch. It catches me by surprise. I pull back. What? He asks. Nothing, I say. Do it again. And he does. He kisses me into the bedroom. He kisses me out of the lingerie. He kisses me underneath the sheets. And when it's just us there, on the precipice, he lifts his face up from mine and asks it, when are we getting married? My brain is scrambled. Undone from the day, the month, the glass and a half of wine I had to prepare myself for this little stunt. David, I breathe out. Can we talk about this later? He kisses my neck, my cheek, the bridge of my nose. Yes. And then he pushes into me. He moves slowly, deliberately, and I feel myself come apart before I even have a chance to begin. He keeps moving on top of me, long after I've returned to my body, to my brain. We are like constellations passing each other, seeing each other's light, but in the distance. It feels impossible how much space there can be in this intimacy, how much privacy. And I think that maybe That is what love is. Not the absence of space, but the acknowledgement of it. The thing that lives between the parts. The thing that makes it possible not to be one, but to be different, to be two. But there is something I cannot shake. Some reckoning that has burrowed into my body, through my very cells. It rises now, flooding, probing, threatening to spill out of my lips. The thing I have kept buried and locked for almost 5 years, exposed to this fraction of light. I close my eyes against it. I will them to stay shut. And when it's over, when I finally open them, David is staring at me with a look I've never seen before. He's looking at me as if he's already gone. Chapter 26. I go down to Bella's and make her tens of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, the only thing, really, I know how to cook. The gallery girls come by. We order from Bouvette, and Bella's favorite waiter brings it himself. And then, the results of the surgery come back. The doctors were right. Stage 3. It's in the lymph system, but not the surrounding organs. Good news, bad news. Bella starts chemo, and impossibly, insanely, we continue wedding planning for 2 months from now, December in New York. I call the wedding planner, the same one a young woman at my firm used. He wrote a book on weddings, How to Wed, Style, Food, and Tradition by Nathaniel Trent. She buys me the book, and I flip through it at work, grateful for the environment, this animal firm where I work, that does not require or ask me to ooh and awe over peonies. We choose a venue, a loft downtown that is, as Nathaniel tells me, the best raw space in Manhattan. What he doesn't say, every nice hotel is booked. This is the best we're going to get. Some couple called their wedding off and we got lucky. The loft will mean more decisions. Everything has to be brought in. But all of the available hotels are bland or too corporate, and we agree to follow Nathaniel's lead and end up with something that splits the difference. At first, the chemo goes well. Bella is a champion. I feel great, she tells me on her way home from the hospital after her second session. No nausea, nothing. I've read, of course, that the beginning is a lie, that there is an air of suspension. Before the chemicals reach your tissues, dig in and start really doing their damage. But I am hopeful. Of course I am. I'm breathing. I'm reading over the IPO offering for QT. Aldridge has already been to California to meet with them. If I choose to, I'll leave in 3 weeks. It's the dream case. Young female entrepreneurs, a managing partner overseeing, complete access to the deal. Of course you should do it, David tells me over a glass of wine and Greek salad takeout. I would be in LA for a month, I say. What about the wedding? And what about Bella? What about missing her doctor's appointments, not being here? Bella is doing well, David says, reaching over the question. She'd want you to go. Doesn't mean I should. David picks up his glass, drinks. The wine is a red we bought at a tasting on Long Island last fall. It was David's favorite. I remember liking it fine, which is the way I feel about it tonight. Wine is wine. You have to make choices sometimes for yourself. It doesn't make you a bad friend, it just means you put yourself first, which you should. What I don't tell him, because I suspect I know that a lecture would follow, is that I don't put myself first. I never have, not when it comes to Bella. Nate said that we should go with the tiger lilies and that no one does roses anymore, I say, skating to the next subject. That's insane, David says. It's a wedding. I shrug. I don't care, I say. Do you? David takes another sip. He appears to be really considering. No, he says. We sit in silence for a few moments. What do you want to do for your birthday? He asks me. My birthday, next week, October 21st. 33. Your magic year, Bella told me. Your year of miracles. Nothing, I say. It's fine. I'll make a reservation, David says. He gets up with his plate and goes to the counter, refilling on tzatziki and roasted eggplant. It's a shame neither one of us cooks. We love to eat so very much. Who should we get to marry us? David asks, and in the same breath, I'll ask my parents for Rabbi Schultz's information. You don't have it?
I don't, he says, his back to me.
This is what marriage is. I know. Tiffs and comfortability, miscommunications, and long stretches of silence. Years and years of support and care and imperfection. I thought we'd be long married by now. But I find, as I sit there, that a hitch of relief hits me when David still doesn't have the rabbi's information. Maybe he's still a step away, too. On Saturday, I go to Bella's chemo appointment with her. She chats amicably to a nurse named Janine, who wears white scrubs with a hand-painted rainbow emblazoned on the back, as she hooks her up to the IV. Chemo is in a center on East 102nd Street, two blocks up from where her surgery was performed. The chairs are wide, and the blankets are soft on the third floor of the Rutenberg Treatment Center. Bella has a cashmere throw with her.
Janine is letting me store a basket here, she tells me in a conspiratorial whisper.
Aaron shows up, and the three of us suck on popsicles and pass the time. 2 hours later, we're in an Uber going back downtown when Bella suddenly clutches my arm.
Can we stop? She asks, and then more urgently, pull over.
We do, on the corner of Park Avenue and 39th Street, and she climbs over Aaron to retch in the street. She starts puking with ferocity. The remains of a technicolor popsicle spew out with the bile. Hold her hair, I tell Aaron, who gently rubs her back in small circles. She waves us off, breathing heavily over bent knees.
I'm fine, she says.
Do you have any tissues? I ask the Uber driver, who mercifully hasn't said anything. Here. He hands a box back. There are clouds on the cardboard. I pluck out three tissues and hand them to Bella, who takes them and wipes her mouth.
Well, that was fun, she says.
She climbs back into the car, but there's a change in her. She knows now that what's to come is hers to face alone. I can't take this part from her. I can't even share it. I have the instinct to reach out, to try and keep the jaws open. But they have clamped shut too quickly. She leans on Aaron. I see the rise and fall of her body, matched in step to her breathing. The first evidence is in, and it isn't good. Aaron helps her upstairs. Svedka is still there, washing dishes that have never been dirty. Bella hasn't fully recovered from surgery, and small things like a few stairs or bending down are still difficult. It will take her months to fully recover, and then there's the chemo.
Let's get you into bed, I say.
Bella is wearing a blue lace Zimmerman dress with a butter soft chocolate leather jacket, and I help her take them off. Aaron stays in the other room. When she's undressed, I can see her scars, some still bandaged, and how much thinner she's gotten in just a few short weeks. She must have lost 15 pounds. I smile, forcing the tide back down. Here, I say. She holds her head out like a child, and I loop a long-sleeved cotton t-shirt over her head, then slide on some soft gray drawstring sweatpants. I pull down the freshly laundered duvet and tuck her inside, fluffing the pillows behind her.
You're so good to me, she says.
She reaches up for my hand, curls her tiny palm into mine. Bella has always had the smallest hands, too little for her body.
You make it easy, I say. You'll be better in no time.
We look at each other for a beat, long enough for us to recognize the terrible fear we're both facing.
I caught you something, Bella says.
Her face breaks out into a smile. She tucks some hair behind her ears, hair that will soon be gone.
Bella, come on, I say. That's not...
She shakes her head.
No, for your birthday.
My birthday is next week.
So it's early. I have an excuse to do things now, don't you think?
I say nothing.
Greg, can you come help me?
Aaron comes in the room, wiping his hands on his jeans. What's up? Bella sits up in bed, pointing excitedly to a gift-wrapped package that leans against her closet wall. Aaron picks it up. I can tell it's not light. On the bed? He asks.
Yeah, here.
Bella removes a throw from her feet and moves her legs into a cross-legged position.
She taps the space next to her, and I go to sit. Open it. The wrapping paper is gold, with a white and silver silk ribbon. Bella is a master gift wrapper, and it gives me some solace, some sign that she did this herself. It feels like proof of stability, of order. I tear it away. Inside is a large frame, a piece of art. Turn it over, she says. I do, with Aaron's help. I saw a print of this on Instagram and immediately knew you needed it. It took forever to find the Alan Grubasik one. I think he only made 12. Everyone at the gallery has been trying to track it down for you, and we found it 2 months ago. A woman in Italy was selling it. We pounced. I'm obsessed. Please tell me you love it. I look at the print in my hands. It's an eye chart, and it reads, I was young. I needed the money. My hands feel numb.
Do you like it? She asks,
her voice an octave lower. Yes, I say. I swallow. I love it.
I thought you would.
Aaron, I say. I can feel him standing there. It seems crazy, impossible that he doesn't know. Whatever happened to that Dumbo apartment? Bella laughs.
Why do you call him Aaron? She asks.
It's fine, he says abruptly. I don't mind.
I know you don't mind, Bella says, but why?
It's his first name, I say, isn't it? I turn my attention to the gift. I run my hand over the glass.
I bought it, the apartment, she tells me.
The Aaron argument dissolves as quickly as it presented.
The rest is for me to know and you to find out.
I push the print to the side. I take her hands in mine. Bella, listen to me. You cannot renovate that apartment. It will be a good investment as raw space. You bought it, fine, just sell it. Promise me you're not going to move in there. Promise. Bella squeezes my hand.
You're crazy, she says. But fine, I promise you, I'm not going to move in there.
Chapter 27. The chemo goes from good to bad to gruesome quickly, too quickly. Next week she's sick, the following one she's weak, and after that she is sunken, her body practically concave. The one saving grace is that her hair doesn't fall out. Session after session, week after week, not even a strand.
It happens sometimes, Dr. Shaw tells me.
He comes to her chemo sessions to check up on her and run through any recent blood work. Today, Jill is there, which might explain why Dr. Shaw and I are in the hallway, a whole room away from where Bella's mother pretends to be dutiful. A patient who doesn't lose their hair. It's rare, though. She's one of the lucky ones.
Lucky. I taste the word in my mouth, rotted. Poor choice of words, he says. We doctors aren't always the most sensitive. I apologize.
No, I say, she has great hair. Dr. Shaw smiles at me. Colorful Nikes peek out from the bottom of his jeans. They point to some kind of life beyond these walls. Does he go home to children? How does he shake the everyday of these patients shrinking inside?
She's lucky that she has such a good support system, he tells me. It isn't the first time he said it. Some patients have to do this alone.
She has 2 more weeks of this, I say. And then she'll do another test?
Yes, we'll check to see if the cancer has been localized. But you know, Danny, because it's in the lymph, it's really about containment. The likelihood of remission in ovarian cancers,
no, I say. She's different. She has her hair. She's different.
Dr. Shaw puts a hand on my shoulder and squeezes gently, but he doesn't say anything. I want to ask him more, like whether he's ever seen a case like this, like what we should prepare for. I want to ask him to tell me what is going to happen. Give me the answers. But he can't. He doesn't know. And whatever he has to say, I'm not interested in hearing.
I go back in the room. Bella's leaning her head against the side of her armchair, her eyes closed. She opens them when I'm in front of her.
Guess what, she tells me, her voice sleepy. Mom is going to take me to dinner and to see the Barbra Streisand musical. Do you want to come?
Jill, dressed in black crepe slacks and a floral print silk blouse with a pussy bow, leans over.
It'll be fun. We'll go to Sardi's before and have some martinis.
Bella, I can feel the anger start to simmer in me. She can barely sit up. She's going to dinner? To a theater? Bella rolls her eyes.
Oh, come on, I can do it.
You're not really supposed to be out right now. Dr. Shaw did say that, and he's definitely mentioned that alcohol could interfere with your medi-
Stop! What are you, my parole officer? Bella fires at me.
It feels like a shot to the stomach. No, I say calmly. I'm not trying to keep you from anything. I'm just trying to keep you well. I'm the one who has been here and who has listened to the doctors. Jill doesn't even bristle. She doesn't even seem to understand the slight.
So have I, Bella says.
She reaches down and tugs her blanket up. I see how thin her legs have become, like two arms. She notices me noticing.
I'm going to get some iced tea, Jill says. Bella, can I get you some iced tea?
Bella doesn't drink iced tea, I say. She hates it. She always has.
Well, Jill says, coffee then.
She doesn't wait for a response, just saunters out of the room like she's in sweaters and headed now toward the shoe department.
What is wrong with you? Bella hisses when she's left.
What is wrong with me?
What is wrong with you? You can't do this tonight, you know that. Why are you acting this way? Did it ever occur to you that maybe I don't need you to tell me how I feel? That maybe I know?
No, I say, it didn't, because that's ridiculous. This isn't about how you feel, which, by the way, is like shit. You threw up 3 times in the car on the way here. Bella looks away. I feel struck by sadness, but it does not push the anger out. Because that is what I feel, angry. And for the first time since her diagnosis, I let it take over. I let the righteous indignation burn a hole through me, through her, through this godforsaken chemical den.
Shut up, Bella says. Something she hasn't said to me since we were 12 years old,
in the back of my parents' station wagon, fighting over God knows what. Not her life, not cancer.
I'm not your project. I'm not some little girl you have to save. You don't know what's better for me than I do.
She struggles to sit up and winces, the needle in her arm shifting. I am overcome with a helplessness so deep it threatens to topple me into her chair.
I'm sorry, Bella, I'm sorry, I say gently now.
For all the things she's going through, for everything. It's okay, let's just finish and I'll take you home.
No,
Bella says. There is a ferocity in her tone that does not give.
I don't want you here anymore.
Bells, don't bells me. You always do this. You've done this forever. You think you know everything, but it's my body, not yours, okay? You're not my mother.
I never said I was.
You didn't have to. You treat me like a child. You think I'm incapable, but I don't need you.
Bella, this is insane. Come on.
Please stop coming to these appointments.
I'm not asking you, she says.
She's practically screaming now.
I'm telling you, you need to leave.
She swallows. There are sores in her mouth. I can tell it takes effort.
Now.
I wander outside. Jill is there juggling a coffee and a tea.
Oh, hello, darling, she says. Cappuccino?
I don't answer her. I keep walking. I keep walking until I start running. I take out my phone. Before I am down the hall, before I have any clear grasp of what I'm doing, I'm scrolling to his name and hitting the green button. He answers after the third ring. Hey, he says. What's wrong? Is she okay? I start to speak, and then instead of words, I'm met with big, hiccuping sobs. I crouch down in the corner of the hallway, let them rake over me. Nurses pass by unmoved. This is the chemo floor, after all. Nothing new to see here. Just the end of the world over and over and over again. I'll be right there, he says, and hangs up.
Chapter 28. She doesn't mean it,
Aaron says. We're sitting at a diner on Lexington, some late-night one named Big Daddy's or Daddy Dan's or something like that. The kind of place that can't afford to be downtown. I'm on my second cup of strong and bitter black coffee. I don't deserve cream. She does, I say. We've been going through the script for the last 20 minutes since Aaron ran up to the hospital's double doors to find me crouching outside. She always felt this way. She just never said it. She's scared. She was so angry with me. I've never even seen her like that before, like she wanted to kill me. She's the one going through it, he says. Right now, she has to think that she's capable of anything, even alcohol. I ignore his attempt at levity. She is, I say. I bite my lip. I don't want to cry anymore. Not in front of him. It's too vulnerable, too close, too near. I just can't believe her parents are behaving this way. You don't know what they're like. Aaron removes an invisible eyelash from his face. You don't know, I repeat. Maybe not, Aaron says. They seem to care. That's good, right? They'll leave, I say. They always do. When she really needs them, they'll be gone. But Danny, Aaron says. He sits forward. I can feel the air molecules around us stiffen. They're here now, and she really needs them. Isn't that what matters? I think about his promise on the street corner. I always believed it was just Bella and me. There was no one she could count on but me. There was no one who would really be there forever but me. Not if they'll eventually leave, I say. Aaron keeps hovering closer. I think you're wrong. I think you don't know, I say. I'm starting to believe it was a mistake calling him. What was I thinking? He shakes his head. You mistake love. You think it has to have a future in order to matter, but it doesn't. It's the only thing that does not need to become at all. It matters only insofar as it exists. Here. Now. Love doesn't require a future. Our eyes lock, and I think that maybe he can read it there. Everything that happened. That maybe, somehow, he has reached back. That he knows. In that moment, I want to tell. I want to tell him if only so he can carry this thing with me. Aaron, I start, and then his cell phone rings. He takes it out. It's work, he says. Hang on. He stands up and leaves the booth. I see him gesturing out by the glass doors emblazoned with the diner's name, Daddy's. The waitress comes over. Do we want any food? I shake my head. Just the check, please. She hands me the bill. She hadn't expected us to stick around, I guess. I leave cash on the table and get my bag. I join Aaron at the door, where he's hanging up. Sorry about that, he says. It's okay, I'm going to head out. I should go back to the office. It's Saturday, he says. Corporate law, I mutter, and I've been gone a lot. He gives me a small smile. He looks disappointed. Thank you for meeting me, I say. Really, thanks for showing up. I appreciate it. Of course, he says. Danny, you can call me anytime. You know that, right? I smile. I nod. The bells on the door jingle on my way out.
Chapter 29. It's the first week of November, and Bella won't speak to me. I call her. I send David over with food. Just give her a little time, he tells me. I don't express the absurdity of his statement to him. I can't even think it, much less say it out loud. Dr. Christine is no more surprised to see me back in her office than I am to be there. She wants to know about my family, and so I tell her about Michael. I remember him less and less these days, what he was like. I try and focus on the details. His laugh, the strange way his forearms hung from his elbows, like there was just too much limb. His brown curly hair like baby ringlets, and his wide brown eyes. How he used to call me pal. How he'd always invite me to hang out in the tent in our backyard, even if his friends were over.
He didn't seem to have any of the hang-ups older brothers usually have about their little sisters. We fought, sure, but I always knew he loved me, that he wanted me around.
Dr. Christine tells me I am learning to deal with a life I cannot control. What she doesn't say, what she doesn't have to, is that I'm failing at it. I still go to the chemo appointments. I just don't go upstairs. I sit in the lobby and read through work emails until I know Bella's finished. The following Wednesday, Dr. Shaw walks by. I'm sitting on a cement ledge, some fake foliage dangling below me, doing some paperwork.
"Humpty Dumpty," he says.
I look up, so startled I nearly fall.
"Hi," he says.
"Hi."
"What are you doing here?"
"Bella," I say. I gesture with my free arm, the one not holding my array of folders, upward to the room where Bella lies, chemicals being pumped into her.
"I just came from there."
Dr. Shaw takes a step closer to me. He peers at my binder disapprovingly.
"Do you need some coffee?" he asks.
I found some crappy vending machine stuff earlier, but it's wearing off quickly.
"It kind of sucks here," I say.
He holds a pointed finger out at me.
"That's because you do not know the tricks. Follow me."
We wind through the ground floor of the treatment center to the back and down a hallway. At the end is a little atrium with a Starbucks cart. I swear it's like seeing a miracle. My eyes go wide. Dr. Shaw notices.
"I know, right?" he says. "It's the best-kept hospital secret. Come on."
He leads me to the cart where a woman in her mid-twenties with two French braids smiles wide at him.
"The usual?" she asks.
He turns to me. "Don't tell anyone, but I'm a tea drinker. That's why Irina here has to know my order."
"The hospital is big on coffee?" I ask.
"More manly," he says, gesturing for me to step forward. I order an Americano, and when our drinks are ready, Dr. Shaw takes a seat at a little metal table. I join him. "I don't want to keep you," I say. "I appreciate the coffee referral."
"It's good for me," he says.
He takes his lid off, letting the steam rise.
"Do you know surgeons are notorious for having the worst bedside manner?"
"Really?" I say. "But I know."
"Yes, we're monstrous. So every Wednesday I try and have coffee with a commoner."
He smiles. I laugh because I know the moment requires it.
"So how is Bella?" he asks.
His pager beeps and he looks at it, setting it on the table.
"I don't know," I say. "You've seen her more recently than I have."
He looks confused. I keep talking. "We had a fight. I'm not allowed upstairs."
"Oh," he says. "I'm sorry to hear that. What happened?"
I'm cognizant of the time, of how little he has.
"I'm controlling," I say, getting to the punch.
Dr. Shaw laughs. It's a nice laugh, odd in this hospital setting.
"I'm familiar with this dynamic," he says, "but she'll come around."
"I don't know," I say.
"She will," he says.
"You're here. One thing I've learned is that you can't try and make this experience above the simplicity of humanity. It won't work." I stare at him. I'm not sure what he means. He can tell. "You're still you. She's still her. You still have emotions. You'll still fight. You can try and be perfect, but it will backfire. Just keep being here instead."
His pager goes off again. This time he snaps the lid back down on his cup. "Unfortunately, duty calls."
He stands and extends his hand.
"Hang in there," he says. "I know the road isn't easy, but stay the course. You're doing good."
I stay sitting near the Starbucks cart for another hour until I know Bella has finished treatment and is safely out of the building. When I head home, I call David, but there is no answer. The following week, I am not at the hospital, but instead on a plane with Aldridge to Los Angeles. Aldridge is seeing another client while we're out there, a pharmaceutical giant who sends their jet for our use. We board with Kelly James, a litigating partner I've never said more than 20 words to over the course of my nearly 5 years at Wachtell. It's a 10-seater, and I take the one in the rear by the window. I lean my head against the glass. I said yes to this trip without considering what it means.
It is, of course, an answer to Aldrich's original question. Yes, yes, I'll take on the case. Yes, I'll commit to this.
You're doing the right thing, David told me last night. This could be huge for your career, and you love this company.
I do, I say. I just can't help but feel like people here need me.
We'll survive, he said. I promise, we'll all survive.
And now here I am, flying over an endless mountain range in pursuit of the ocean. We're staying at Casa del Mar in Santa Monica, right on the beach. My room is on the ground level, with a terrace that extends onto the boardwalk. The hotel is shabby chic, Hamptons meets European opulence. I like it. We have a dinner meeting with Jordy and Anya tonight, but when I reach my room, it's only 11 a.m. We picked up half a day on our way across the country. I change into shorts, a t-shirt, and a sun hat. My Russian Jew skin has never met a sun it particularly got on with, and decide to take a walk on the beach. The temperature is warm and getting hotter, in the mid-80s by lunchtime, but there's a cool breeze off the ocean. For the first time in weeks, I feel as if I'm not simply surviving. We go to dinner at Ivy at the shore, a restaurant down the street from Casa del Mar, but Aldridge still calls a car. Kelly is in town to see another client, so it's just Aldridge and me. I'm wearing a navy shift dress with lilac flowers and navy espadrilles, the most casual I've ever been in a work environment. But it's California. These women are young, and we're by the ocean. I want to wear flowers. We get to the restaurant first. Rattan chairs with floral backs and pillows pepper the restaurant as diners in jeans and dinner jackets clink glasses, laughing. We sit.
I'm going to insist on the calamari, Aldrich says. It's delectable.
He's wearing a light gray suit with a purple paisley shirt. If you photographed us together, you might think it had been planned. Is there anything we should go over? I ask him. I have the company stats memorized, but
this is just a get-to-know-you meeting, so they feel comfortable. You know the ropes.
No meeting is just anything, I say.
That is true, but if you try for an agenda, you often get an undesired outcome.
Jordy and Anya arrive in tandem. Jordy is tall in high-waisted pants and a cowl-neck sweater. Her hair is down and wet at the ends. She looks like a bohemian dream, and I am reminded, for not the first time, of Bella. Anya wears jeans, a t-shirt, and a blazer. Her hair is short and slicked back. She talks with her eyes. Are we late? She says. She's skittish, I can tell. No matter, we'll win them over.
Not at all, Aldrich says. You know us New Yorkers. We don't know anything about your traffic patterns.
Jordy sits next to me. Her perfume is heady and dense.
Ladies, I'd like you to meet Danielle Cohan. She's our best and brightest senior associate. And she's been a huge boon to your IPO evaluation already.
You can call me Danny, I say, shaking each of their hands.
We love Aldridge, Jordy tells me, but does he have a first name?
It's never to be used, I tell her, before mouthing Miles. Aldridge smiles.
What are we drinking tonight? He asks the group.
A waiter materializes, and Aldridge orders a bottle of champagne and a bottle of red for dinner.
Cocktails, anyone? He inquires.
Anya gets an iced tea.
How long do you think this'll take? She asks.
Dinner or taking your company public?
Aldridge does not look up from his menu.
I've been a big fan of yours for a while now, I say. I think what you've done with the space is brilliant.
Think, Jordy starts, but Anya cuts her off.
We didn't do anything with the existing space. We created a new one, she says.
She eyes Jordy as if to say, lock it up.
I'm curious, though, I say. I aim my question at both of them equally.
Why now? At this, Aldridge looks up from his menu and grabs a passing waiter.
We'd like the calamari immediately, please.
Aldridge winks at me.
Jordy looks to Anya, as if unsure how to answer, and I feel a question answered before it has been raised. I swallow it back down. Not now.
We're at the point where we don't want to work as hard as we have been on the same thing, Jordy says. We'd like the revenue to be able to turn our attentions to new ventures.
I feel the familiarity in her speech, the measured, calculated words. Maybe it's all true, but none of it feels authentic, so I push. Why give away control of something you own when you don't have to? At this, Jordy busies herself with her water glass. Anya's eyes narrow. I can feel Aldridge shift next to me. I have no idea why I'm doing this. I know exactly why I'm doing this.
Are you trying to talk us out of this? Anya asks.
She directs her question to Aldridge.
Because I was under the impression this was a kickoff dinner.
I look at Aldridge, who stays silent. He is, I realize, not going to answer for me.
No, I say, I just like to understand motivation. It helps me do my job.
Anya likes this answer, I can tell. Her shoulders drop perceptively.
The truth is, I'm not sure. We've spoken a lot about this. Jordy knows I'm on the fence.
We've been at QT for almost 10 years, Jordy says, repeating what is no doubt a familiar line. It's time for something else.
I don't know why we have to give up control in order to have that, Anya says.
The champagne arrives in a flourish of glasses and bubbles. Aldridge pours. To QT, he says. A smooth IPO process and a lot of money. Jordy clinks his glass, but Anya and I keep our eyes on each other. I see her searching me, asking the question that will never be spoken at this table. What would you do?
Chapter 30. 2 hours later, I'm at the bar upstairs at the hotel. I should sleep, but I can't. Every time I try, I think about Bella, about what a terrible friend I am to be this far away, and my eyes shoot back open. I'm leaning over my second dirty martini when Aldridge comes in. I squint. I'm too drunk for this.
Danny, he says. May I?
He doesn't wait for my response, but takes the seat next to me.
Tonight was good, I say, trying for steady.
I think I'm slurring my words.
You were very engaged, he says. Must have felt good.
Sure, I deadpan. Wonderful. Aldridge's eyes flit down to my martini glass and back to me.
Danielle, he says, are you all right?
I'm suddenly aware that if I speak, I will cry. And I have never cried in front of a boss, not once. Not even at the DA's office, where morale was so bad that we had a designated room for hysterical outbursts. I pick up my water glass. I sip. I set it back down. No, I say. He gestures to the waiter.
I'll have a kettle on the rocks, 2 lemons, he says.
The waiter turns, but Aldridge calls him back.
No, actually, I'll have a scotch. Neat.
He takes off his suit jacket, drapes it over the empty stool next to him, and then goes about rolling back his sleeves. Neither of us speaks during this interval, and by the time the ritual is complete, his drink is in front of him, and I no longer feel as if I'm going to cry.
So, he says, you can begin, or I can do my ankle cuffs next. I laugh.
The alcohol has made everything loose. I feel the emotions there right on the surface, not tucked and tidy where I normally keep them.
I'm not sure I'm a good person, I say.
I didn't know that's what was inside my head, but once I say it, I know it's true.
Interesting, he says. A good person.
My best friend is very sick.
Yes, Aldridge says, I know that.
And we're in a fight. He takes a sip of scotch.
What happened?
She thinks I'm controlling, I say, repeating the truth. At this, Aldridge laughs, just like Dr. Shaw. It's a hearty belly laugh.
Why does everyone think that's so funny? I ask. Because you are, he says. You were quite controlling tonight, for example.
Was that bad?
Aldridge shrugs. I guess we'll see. How did it feel?
That's the problem, I say. It felt great. I loved it. My best friend is... She's sick, and tonight I'm in California happy about some clients at dinner. What kind of a person does that make me?
Aldridge nods, like he understands it now, gets what this is about. You are upset because you think you need to quit your life and be by her side.
No, she won't let me. I just shouldn't be happy doing this.
Ah, right, happiness. The enemy of all suffering.
He takes another sip. We drink in silence for a moment.
Did I ever tell you what I originally wanted to be?
I stare at him.
We're not exactly braiding each other's hair besties. How would I know? I'm assuming this is a trick question and that you're going to say lawyer. Aldridge laughs. No, no. I was going to be a shrink. My father was a psychiatrist, so is my brother. It's a strange career choice for a teen, but it always seemed like the right one. I blink at him. Shrink? I would have been terrible at it. All that listening? I don't have it in me. I can feel the alcohol weaving its way through my system, making everything hazy and rosy and faded. What happened? I went to Yale, and my first day there I had a philosophy course, first order logic, a discussion of meta theory. It was for my major, but the professor was a lawyer, and I just thought, why diagnose when you can determine? He stares at me for a long time. Finally, he puts a hand on my shoulder. You are not wrong for loving what you do, he says. You are lucky. Life doesn't hand everyone a passion in their profession. You and I won that round. It doesn't feel like winning, I say. No, Aldridge says. It often doesn't. That dinner over there? He points outside past the lobby and the palm tree prints. We didn't cement that. You loved it because for you, the win is the game. That is how you know you're meant for it. He takes his hand off my shoulder. He downs the rest of his drink in a neat sip. You're a great lawyer, Danny. You're also a good friend and a good person. Don't let your own bias throw the case. The next morning, I take a car up to Montana Avenue. It's overcast. The fog of the morning won't burn off until noon, but by then we'll already be up in the air. I stop at Pete's Coffee and take a stroll down the little shopping street, even though everything is still closed. A few lycra-clad mothers wheel their distracted toddlers while they talk. The morning bike crew passes by on their way out to Malibu. I used to think I could never live in Los Angeles. It was for people who couldn't make it in New York. The easy way out. Moving would mean admitting that you'd been wrong. That everything you'd said about New York, that there was nowhere else in the world to live, that the winters didn't bother you, that carrying 4 grocery bags back home in the pouring rain or hailing snow wasn't an inconvenience, that having your own car was, in fact, your dream, that life wasn't, isn't, hard. But there is so much space out here. It feels like there is room to not have to store every single piece of off-season clothing under your bed, maybe even to make a mistake. I take my coffee back to the hotel. I walk across the concrete bike path into the sand and down to the ocean. Far to the left, I can see some surfers zigzagging through the waves, around one another, like their movements are choreographed. A big oceanic ballet, moving continuously toward the shore. I snap a picture. I love you, I write. What else is there to say? Chapter 31. It's really a question of eggshell or white, the woman says. I'm standing in the middle of Mark Ingram, a bridal salon in Midtown, an untouched flute of champagne on a glass coffee table alone. My mother was supposed to come in, but the university called a last-minute staff meeting to discuss a confidential matter regarding donations for next year, and she's stuck in Philadelphia. I'm supposed to send her pictures. It's now mid-November, and Bella hasn't spoken to me in 2 weeks. She's finishing her second round of chemo on Saturday, and David tells me not to bother her until it's over. I've heeded his advice impossibly. It's excruciating not being there, not knowing. The wedding invitations have gone out. We're receiving RSVPs, the menu is set, the flowers are ordered. All that is left is getting a dress, so here I am, standing in it. Like I said, with this time frame, it's really off the rack, so it's pretty much only the dresses hanging here. The sales lady gestures to the 3 dresses to our right, 1 eggshell, 2 white. She crosses her arms, checks her watch. She seems to think I'm wasting her time, but doesn't she know? This is a sure sale. I have to leave with the dress today. This one seems fine, I say. It's the first one I've tried on. I was never one of those girls who dreamed about her wedding. That was always Bella, I remember her standing in front of my mirror with a pillowcase over her head, reciting vows to the glass. She knew exactly what the dress would look like, silk organza with spools of unfolding tulle, a long lace veil. She dreamed of the decor, white calla lilies, puffy peonies, and tiny tea candles. There would be a harpist. Everyone would ooh and ah when she stepped out of the shadows and into the aisle. They'd stand. She'd float down to the faceless, nameless man, the one who made her feel like the entire universe was conspiring for her love and hers alone. I knew I'd get married in the way you know you'll get older, and that Saturday comes after Friday. I didn't think that much about it. And then I met David, and everything fit, and I knew it was what I had been looking for. That we were meant to unfold these chapters together, side by side. But I never thought about the wedding. I never thought about the dress. I never pictured myself in this moment standing here now. And if I had, I never would have seen this. The dress I wear is silk and lace. It has a string of buttons down the back. The bodice fits poorly. I don't fill it out properly. I shake my arms, and the saleswoman races into frame. She pinches the back of the dress with a giant clothespin. "We can fix that," she says. She looks at me in the mirror. Her face betrays sympathy. Who comes here alone and buys the first dress they try on? "We'll have to rush it, but we can do that." "Thank you," I say. I feel like I might cry, and I do not want these tears being misinterpreted as nuptial joy. I do not want to hear her delighted squeals or see her knowing glance, so in love. I turn swiftly to the side. "I'll take it." Her face registers confusion and then brightens. She's just made a sale. $3,000 in 13 minutes. Must be some kind of record. Maybe I'm pregnant. She probably thinks I'm pregnant. "Wonderful," she says. "I love this neckline on you. It's so flattering. Let's just take some measurements." She pins me. The curve of my waist and the length of the hem, the lay of the shoulders. When she leaves, I look at myself in the mirror. The neckline is high. She is wrong, of course. It does not flatter me at all. It does nothing to show off my collarbones, the slope of my neck. For a brief, wondrous moment, I think about calling David, telling him we need to postpone the wedding. We'll get married next year, at the Plaza, or in Massachusetts, at the Wheatley. I'll get a ridiculous dress you have to custom order, the Oscar de la Renta one with the brocade flowers. We'll have the top florist, the best band. We'll dance to The Way You Look Tonight, under the most delicate strands of white and gold twinkle lights. The entire ceiling will be made of roses. We'll plan a honeymoon in Tahiti or Bora Bora. We'll leave our cell phones in the bungalow and swim out to the edge of the earth. We'll drink champagne under the stars, and I'll wear white, only white, for 10 days straight. We'll make all the right decisions. But then I hear the clock on the wall, the tick, tick, ticking of the second hand, bringing us closer and closer to December 15th. I take off the dress. I pay for it. On my walk home, Aaron calls me. "We got the test results back from the last round," he says. "It's not good." I should feel surprised, shouldn't I? I should feel like I'm stopped dead in my tracks. The world now, in light of this news, should slow down, stop spinning. The taxis should sputter still. The music on the street should stretch until silent. But I'm not. I've been waiting. "Ask her if she wants me there," I tell him. He pauses. I hear a lapse in breathing, the white noise sounds of apartment motion somewhere a few rooms over. I wait. After about 2 minutes, an eternity, he comes back to the phone. She says yes. I run. Chapter 32. To my relief, and also grief, she looks like she did 3 weeks ago. No worse, no better. She still has her hair, and her eyes still have that sunken, hollow quality. She isn't crying. She isn't smiling. Her face looks blank. And it is this that terrifies me the most. Seeing her cry is not, out of context, a cause for alarm. She has always worn her emotions inside out, the soft, nubile vicissitudes subject to every change in wind. But her stoicism, her unreadability, I'm not used to. I've always been able to look at Bella and read it all there, see exactly what she needed. Now, I cannot. Bella, I start. I heard... She shakes her head.
Let's deal with us first.
I nod. I come to stand next to the bed, but I do not sit on it.
I'm scared, she says.
I know, I say gently.
No, she says. Her voice gets stronger.
I'm scared of leaving you with this. I don't say anything, because all at once I'm 12. I'm standing in the doorway of my room as my mother screams. I'm listening to my father, my strong, brave, good father, trying to make sense, asking the questions. But who was driving? But was he going the speed limit? As if it mattered, as if reason could bring him back. I've always been waiting, haven't I? For tragedy to show up once again on my doorstep. Evil that blindsides. And what is cancer if not that? If not the manifestation of everything I've spent my life trying to ward off? But Bella, it should have been me. If this is my story, then it should have been mine. Don't talk like that, I say. But if I know Bella's tells, she, of course, knows mine. She is no less equipped than I am at reading the impressions of my moods and thoughts as they saunter and sprint across my face. It works both ways. You're not going anywhere, I tell her. We're going to fight this just as we always have. And in that moment, it's true. It's true because it has to be. It's true because there are no other options. Despite that chemo hasn't kept it at bay, despite that it's spread to her abdomen, despite. Look, she says. She holds up her hand. On it is an engagement ring perched daintily on her finger. You're getting married? I ask her.
When I'm better, she says.
I get in bed next to her.
You got engaged and you didn't call me? It happened at home last night, she tells me. He was bringing me dinner.
What? She looks at me, her eyebrows knit.
Pasta from Wild.
I make a face. I still can't believe you like it there.
It's gluten-free, she says, not poison. They have good spaghetti.
So anyway,
she says. He brought me the pasta, and on top of the Parmesan was the ring.
What did he say?
She looks at me, and she's right there. Bella, my Bella. Her face bright, and her eyes lit. You'll think it's corny. I won't, I whisper. I promise. He told me that he's been looking for me forever, and even though the situation is less than ideal, he knows that I'm his soulmate. And that he was always fated to end up with me.
She blushes pink. Fated. I swallow. He's right, I say. You always wanted someone who would just know it was you. You always wanted your soulmate, and you found him. Bella turns to me. She takes her hand and places it on the duvet between us.
I'm going to ask you something, she says. And if I'm wrong, you don't have to answer.
I feel my heart rate accelerate.
What if she couldn't? I know you think we're really different, and we are. I get that. I'll never be someone who checks my weather app before I go outside or knows the number of days eggs can last in the fridge. I haven't strategically built my life the way you have. But you're wrong in thinking, she wets her lips. I think you're capable of this kind of love, too. And I don't think you have it.
I let that sit between us for a moment. What's making you say that? I ask her.
Don't you think there's a reason you never got married? Don't you think there's a reason you've been engaged for almost 5 years? A 5-year engagement was never in your plan.
We're getting married now, I say.
Because, Bella says. Her voice gets small.
She seems to fold into herself next to me.
You think you're on a clock?
December 15th.
That's not true. I love David.
I know you do, she says, but you're not in love with him. You may have been at first, but if you were, I never really saw it. And I don't have the luxury of pretending anymore. And what I realized is that you don't either. If there's a clock ticking toward anything, it should be your happiness.
Bella. I feel something rise in my chest, and then it's tumbling out onto the duvet between us.
I'm not sure I'm capable of it, I tell her. Not the kind you mean. But you are, she says. I wish you knew that. I wish you understood that you could have love beyond your wildest dreams. Stuff movies are made of. You're meant for that, too.
I don't think I am.
You are. You know how I know?
I shake my head.
Because that's the way you love me.
Bella, I say, listen to me. You're going to be fine. People do this all the time. They defy the odds every damn day. She holds her arms out to me. I give her a careful hug.
Who would have thought, she says.
I know. I feel her shake her head against me.
No, she says, that you'd end up being someone who believed.
And that's the thing I know more than anything, as I hold Bella's shrunken form in my arms. She is extraordinary. For once in my life, the numbers don't apply.